Joey Seed.
Back-to-back Joeys. That might be a little much.
All right, Jeremiah, please.
So the last time I taught here, we went to this chapter, and for a totally different reason than why we're going there now. But in Jeremiah 32, we looked a couple weeks ago at the revelation God gave Jeremiah to buy a field from his nephew. I got it wrong last time, but a relative, let's put it that way. And he bought the field, and then after he did all the actions of buying the field, then God revealed the purpose. And we're going to read the purpose again today. 32. And in verse 14, it says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, take these evidences," so the deeds, the titles to the land that he had just purchased, "this evidence of the purchase, both which is sealed and the evidence which is open, and put them in earthen vessels that they may continue many days." So put them in a pot so they don't go bad, right? And here's why. "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall be possessed again in this," what? "Land." Okay, so as we looked at last time, Jeremiah lived in and around Jerusalem, and his field that he was going to that he bought was right outside the city walls of Jerusalem in this place called Anathoth. And he bought it so that to show everybody that even though they were going into captivity into Babylon, that at the end of 70 years, as it had been prophesied, they would return. And God's putting Jeremiah's money where his mouth is as a prophet, and he's buying this field to demonstrate to everybody that even though we're leaving, this stuff will be possessed again. Okay? So after 70 years, lo and behold, God's word was true. That God brought the children of Israel, at least some of them, back out of Babylon into Judea and into Jerusalem. And we're going to look at one of the accounts of what happened in this time called the post-exilic time, which is just a fancy way of saying after they were exiled into Babylon. So let's turn to the book of Esther. There are three books in the Bible that are commonly referred to as the post-exilic books. Now, there's a lot of books in the Bible written after the exile, but these three books kind of give the narration of the history of events that's going on after the children of Israel went into Babylon and came back to Jerusalem, as God had promised, as demonstrated by Jeremiah and a host of other prophets. So, one of the books is Esther, and that's what we're going to look at today. The other two are Ezra and Nehemiah. So if you've ever wondered why the Bible is in, at least in this section, in this order, these books are grouped together for this reason. It's Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. And they're all showing different aspects, different historical accounts of the different children of Israel during this time period. Now, there are three big groups that needed to be examined. There was a group that came back first into the land. They were led by this guy named Zerubbabel, and they came into the land and fulfilled God's promise that they would return to the land. There's another guy named Nehemiah who comes later and brings a different group of children of Israel back to Jerusalem, and they repair the wall around the city. Now, that accounts for a fraction of how many Judeans were brought into Babylon. The bulk of the Judeans who got carried into captivity and their descendants did not return. Esther deals with them. The children of Israel, who are still God's people, but they're still living in Babylon during the time when God's people are returning back to Jerusalem. And what's really neat about this, as we'll see as we examine this book, is that God's purposes for his children that stayed in the Babylonian area helped and influenced and delivered God's plans that he had for the children, for his children that came back. So the book of Esther, we're going to start in chapter 1. I had the idea of just reading the whole thing. We're not doing that, just so you know. It's 10 chapters long. And I want to hit some highlights today. The reason I want to hit highlights is because in my personal estimation, Esther is one of the best books in the Bible. It's one of the best books specifically just to sit down and read. It's totally readable. Everything about it is understandable. There's just a very surface story that is enjoyable and a great thing to sit down, start in chapter 1, read through chapter 10, and it's enjoyable and comprehensible. There's also a depth to the book that we're going to get into a little bit that I want to highlight so that this week, if you have the inclination, pick up your Bible and read it straight through and see how God's working mightily in this situation. Now, Esther is a unique book in the Bible. It was written in about 485 BC, thereabouts, and it's written in this post-exilic time, so when people are returning back from Babylon. But uniquely, it does not mention one time, does not mention God. It does not one time mention the Bible. It does not one time mention prayer, faith, hope, any of the major concepts that are deep and throughout the entire Bible. Esther doesn't say it explicitly once. But what's interesting about that is the meaning of the word Esther itself. Now, Esther is a Persian name. And if you understand its etymology in Persian, it means star. But when Hebrews would try and pronounce Esther, it would come out as the most closely associated Hebrew word, which is Hester. And Hester in Hebrew means hidden. And that's fitting because it's exactly what's going on in this book, is that God's influence is evident, but it's hidden. And when you read it, you can see the fingerprints of God throughout the entire situation that's happening, but it's not explicitly mentioned. And we'll see some of that today. So Esther chapter 1, verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," that is Ahasuerus, "which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces." So 127 provinces. Now what this is describing is the king of this king, Ahasuerus, the king ruling over in Babylon, he's a Persian king, a Medo-Persian empire. He's ruling over 127 provinces that span from India to Ethiopia. What that's describing is the height of this empire before it ever has any downfall, which this empire does slide into decline and get conquered. But at the height of it, this guy Ahasuerus is the king over it. Now, Ahasuerus is not his name. Ahasuerus is a title. It's a title like king or Caesar. When you'd say Caesar, you meant a person when they were alive, but you also meant their lineage. It's like calling him king. A lot of people believe that this is Xerxes I, which is the king who invaded Greece and lost at Thermopylae. If anyone's ever seen the movie 300... it's the really gay-looking dude in the movie. If that's true, which it doesn't have to be true, it could be another king who would be his relative ruling about the same time at the height of this empire. But if it is him, there's an interesting story that highlights the type of king that he was. Is when he wanted to invade Greece and expand his empire, he got to the straits of, and I forget the name of it, but there's a strait, a waterway that divides Asia from Greece. And he wanted to cross it in boats. And every time he would get this million-man army to try and get him across the water, the storm would come up and the waves would get too choppy and he couldn't cross it. So what he did is he ordered his army's torturers to come out with whips and whip the sea because the sea defied him. And he thought that he was king over everything. He thought he was the biggest deal, that so much so that if the seas defied him, the seas got whipped. So that's the type of king that this potentially was. So that's Ahasuerus, the king. "That in those days, when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom," which is in Shushan, the palace, "in the third year of his reign, he made a" what? "feast and to all the princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes of provinces being before him. And what chapter 1 does is it shows this king at the height of his power. And it starts with this feast. This book is very interesting because it uses feasts and fasts to illustrate ebb and flow of circumstance. So here, at least in Ahasuerus' case, this is the height of his reign. And he's calling all his princes and all his rulers over. And what he's going to do, we're not going to read it all, but he shows off his great wealth. He shows them, look how awesome my feast is. Look at all the marble I have. Look at all the gold I have. Look at everything that my kingdom is. And he shows it off. So much so that he wants to show off his wife. He thinks his wife is the hottest girl in all Persia Media. So what he does is first of all, they get hammered drunk. That's part of the story. So they get hammered drunk, and while he's hammered drunk, he says, tell Vashti, my wife, tell her to come and show off the crown to all my guests. And sort of the hidden meaning behind that is have her wear the crown, but probably have her wear only the crown, nothing else. So she says, no, thank you, please. And so this makes him irate, just drunk and mad and, you know, wondering what he should do. So he consults his guys, and his guys tell him, oh, we can't have this. She can't be saying no to you. You're the king. If you're the king and you're getting defied by your wife, what happens when I tell my wife to do something? She's not going to listen. So they take Vashti. They take away her title. They take away all her standing, and they kick her out, send her into exile. And the king says, I never want to see her again. Well, tough story for Vashti. She's just trying to stand up for what's presumably good, not just flaunting around naked in front of all these guys, all her husband's guests, trying to really to honor him, probably. But she gets the short end of the stick. She gets exiled. Then we get to chapter 2. Chapter 2 is filled with the hangover of the drunken party in chapter 1. It's because Ahasuerus is now lonely, and he says, dang it, I had the hot girl. And now I kicked her out, and I'm feeling lonely and sad. So, chapter 2, we're going to read verse 5. It says, now in Shushan, the palace, there were a certain Jew whose name was what?
Mordecai.
Some people pronounce this Mordecai. That might be more accurate. I hate saying it that way, so we're going to call it Mordecai. The son of Jairai, the son of Shemi, the son of Kish, and Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried him away. And he brought up Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took his own daughter. So he took her as his daughter. So it's interesting here, this character Mordecai. The Bible doesn't tell us too much about him. It tells us a little bit more about him than just what's in the book of Esther. But if you read Josephus, it's in his writing on the Antiquity of the Jews. He identifies at this time period a man named Mordecai as the ambassador of the Jews. And that would fit with this story, is because as we'll see, Mordecai has access into the king's palace. And so this character Mordecai is a believer. He's one of God's people. He was exiled, but he's now in the capital of Persia. And he has a relationship with the king, probably as an ambassador to all the Jews who were in the empire. Now, interesting, this will come up, but it's very interesting to note that all the Jews that have gone back into Judea are still in the Persian Empire. So the events that are happening in the book of Esther would have had far-reaching implications even to the Jews who have already left. So he's a good man, this Mordecai, and he has an adopted daughter named Esther. And we learn here that Esther's parents had died, which is probably an unfortunate circumstance of being captives in a foreign land, is that there's wars associated with that, and there's death that goes along with wars. So presumably, there were a lot of these types of orphans, and Mordecai took care of Esther as his own daughter. Now, what happens in chapter 2 is The king Ahasuerus is lonely, and he wants to have basically who wants to be next queen of Persia game show. And so, yeah, it is like who wants to marry a millionaire? It's like this is that version back in that day. And so Mordecai puts his adopted daughter Esther into this contest, and lo and behold, she is the winner. She wins. She's the best, the pick of any girl in the entire empire. Ahasuerus sees her and is like, that is the one. I want her. And he makes her queen. It's not just to fill a lonely spot in his life. He takes the crown off Vashti and gives it to Esther. So we'll pick that up in verse 17. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release of the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. So as I said, the first feast in this is highlighting the top reign of Ahasuerus. Now, from the perspective of Esther, here's this great feast. Again, another high point. She won. She's the pick of all the women in the entire kingdom, and now she's queen. This ascendancy, this happy moment, is represented by a feast. And when the virgins were gathered together, verse 19, the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. So this is where Mordecai often hangs out, and this is probably indicative of him being the ambassador, staying close by so that he could talk to the king on behalf of the Jews when needed. Esther had not shown her kindred nor her people as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like when she was brought up with him. Now, verse 20 starts the hidden influence in this book of God. And we can see how God is working with his man Mordecai to give information to Esther to say, it might not make sense right now in the story, but keep this to yourself. Don't tell the king that you're a Judean. That's what this verse is. Okay? Verse 21. Here's another marker of the indication of God working behind the scenes to help Esther. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlain, Bigthan and Teresh, the original gangsters from 485 B.C. Bigthan and Teresh. That's actually their rapper name. So they had a big media contract in media called Media. Never mind. Bigthan and Teresh, of those who kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hands on or to kill King Ahasuerus. So these are his guards. They're set to watch the door, and they're like, we're going to kill this guy. They had opportunity. They were about to pull the trigger, verse 22. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. So Mordecai finds out about it. He either overhears it or God reveals it to him. Either way, it's God putting Mordecai in the right place to get the right information. And now Esther is queen next to the king, so he has an outlet. He tells her, she tells him, this is what Mordecai said is about to happen. The plot's discovered, verse 23, and when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. So they figured it out to be true. Mordecai's not just making this up. So we can see how Mordecai and Esther's standing is improving in the court of the king. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So, it's discovered. They save the king. King writes it down in the book of the Chronicles so he won't forget, and that'll come up again later. Now, chapter 3. After these things, so after this feast, after Esther becomes queen of Persia, wins the competition, after Mordecai, her adopted father, saves the king's life by direction of God, then we see chapter 3, verse 1. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammanatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Now, we saw in chapter 1 the king getting some advice from his advisors saying, yeah, kick Vashti out of here. We don't like her. She's going to undermine our marriages back at home. Then the king regrets it. the king has this habit of having all these terrible advisors throughout this entire book. And one of the most terrible choices he makes is this guy, Haman. And he promotes him above everybody. He's like, you're going to be my right-hand guy, Haman. And Haman is on the up. Verse 2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. They're a bunch of bootlickers. They think, oh, man, Haman's number two. Let's lick his boots, and that'll help us out. We'll get on the climb. For the king had so commanded concerning Haman. But Mordecai, what did he do? He bowed not. Nor did Haman reverence. All right. So we see here a start of the illustration of Mordecai's character. We saw him take in Esther as his own daughter. We see him in communication with God and God favoring him by putting him to discover the plot of Bigthan and Teresh. And then we see him here just standing up for what is right despite what the flow of the circumstances. And Mordecai, when everybody else is bowing down to Haman, refuses to bow because he's only going to serve the one true God. And this starts the illustration of the spiritual war that's going on in the book of Esther. It's never mentioned by name, but we can see the contrast between Haman and Mordecai as a contrast between darkness and evil and God's people. Verse 4. Now it came to pass when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he was told them that he was a Jew. Now this comes up, is that this group of people, these Jews, are represented by Mordecai, and Mordecai is refusing to bow. So Haman takes this as a personal insult, as we'll see, but it also becomes a bigger deal because Mordecai, as representing the Jews, is showing that the Jews won't bow down when the king says. Okay? Verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, so people told on Mordecai, Haman started looking to see if Mordecai was indeed not bowing, and he wasn't. Nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of what? Wrath. This starts to illustrate the characteristics of Haman, who has everything. Number two only to the king. Huge ascendancy, right? At the height of everything, this one guy not bowing down and paying him reverence consumes his whole life. He becomes full of wrath, and we'll see a little bit more of this later. But it's indicative of who his master is. For as Haman follows after the devil, as we'll see indicated, think about the story of the devil. He was highest up in the heavens. What does it say in Ezekiel? That his body was made out of jewels. He was the angel of light. He was the shining one. He was up there. Damn, archangel, top of the line. But he couldn't handle not being as good as God. He couldn't handle the things that were made him just a little bit lower. And as a result, he had this huge fall. Haman is following after those characteristics. Whereas Mordecai is pretty out there on his own. Everybody else is bowing, but he knows who the one true God is, and he's refusing to bow to this. Verse 6. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had shown him that people the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. In the first month, that is, the month Nisan, in the 12th year of the king Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is the month Adar, the month of March, more or less. But we see this, them casting Pur, throwing lots. Haman has devised in his mind that he's full of wrath and that he wants to destroy the Jews. So what he does is he goes and seeks out this spiritual advice, this casting of Pur, to see when the lots are right to bring his case before the king. So this is another illustration of where Haman bows his knee, is that he's following after these devilish traditions. Here, casting lots or casting Pur. So Haman, very sneakily throughout the rest of this chapter, goes before the king. He gets the king to decree it. Haman gets some money, and he gets the king's signet ring. And he makes this decree that on this certain day, anyone can attack and destroy the Jews anywhere in the entire kingdom. You can go and you can kill them. And if you kill them, then you can take all their stuff, incentivizing it. And so he gets this money from the treasury. You can take their stuff. Here's a great incentive package. Just go kill you some Jews, and everything's going to be great. So word gets back to Mordecai of what Haman has done because Mordecai was being righteous before God. Now, isn't that a trip? That we'll read it in chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. And it came even before the king's gate, for none might enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Verse 3, in every province whithersoever the king commanded and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews and what? Fasting. So you see we've gone from feasting to now fasting. And we've seen this low point start where the Jews have this decree out against them where they're basically going to all get annihilated. And weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So picture Mordecai. Picture him just saying, I'm going to do what's right before God. It's wrong for me to bow down to Haman. I'm just not going to do it. So he's standing on his virtues. He's standing up for God. And this comes out of it. Not only is it just your neck on the line, Mordecai, it's all of God's people. They're all in trouble now because of you. Would that give you doubt? Would that give you second thought? That what you thought you were doing for God all of a sudden has turned around and become this great thing down to this lowly thing? Circumstances have turned 180 degrees. I think it would give a lot of people pause. Am I really doing what's right before God? If I was, why is all this evil befalling us? Well, let's read on and see what happens. Chapter 4, we'll read verse 11. Yeah, I'll fill in a little. So, thankfully, there's a little bit of hope here because Mordecai is still the adopted father of Esther, and Esther is still queen next to Ahasuerus. So Mordecai has the great opportunity to go and talk to Esther and say, hey, Esther, remember that guy who you married? Remember that contest they put you in? How about putting in a plug for the Jews? All right? Verse 11. All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come into the inner come into the king in the inner court who is not called, there is one law of this to be put to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. So this is Esther's response when Mordecai says, go and talk to the king about this decree he just put out. And she says, oh, wait a minute. If I go into the inner court, then there's only one rule. I wasn't called. I'm getting axed. Unless he holds out his golden scepter. Now, this golden scepter is one of the more potent illustrations of Christ in the book of Esther. So when you think about it, God is perfect. God has never done anything to lower himself. God keeps his standing in heaven as perfect God, faultless, and never has descended down to the level of fallen man. Did you know that? That even when man came down in the fall, even man when we were corrupted by sin, God, to continue a relationship, did not lower himself down to our fallen level. What God did was he sent Christ to raise us back up to his level. Because God is perfect throughout all eternity, but he also wants a relationship with fallen us. So here in this illustration, we see that the king, in this analogy, would be standing in for God, perfect, unapproachable God, except if he holds out his golden scepter. And we know through history they would have held it out with his right hand. And so who is currently sitting on the right hand of God making intercession for us? It's Jesus Christ. And so as we approach God, we didn't earn it. We weren't worthy enough to go into his inner court. But we were allowed because of this scepter that God held out. This one who Jesus Christ made it okay for us to approach perfect God. And so we can see some of the traces of Christ in the coming one in this book. Verse 12. So Esther's saying, well, anyway, I can't go into the inner court. Are you kidding? Unless he holds out a scepter, I'm getting... Verse 12. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to him, to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. Now, if you read this and you miss the context of who Mordecai is to Esther, you miss something in it. Mordecai is not saying, Esther, if you don't say anything, you're hosed. What he's saying is, if I'm with you as your father, your father's house will be destroyed also. Because, by the way, her father's house was already destroyed. Mother and father were both already dead. But Mordecai was her father in this circumstance. And he's saying, I'm in it with you. We're doing this together. Don't think that we have the opportunity to skate by our favored position. Our lots are cast in with all the Jews. And then it goes on to say, at the end of verse 14, and who knoweth whether thou art come to this kingdom for such a time as this? Now this operative word, the word time, illustrates what's coming up next in this narrative, is that Esther was in this position for this time. Mordecai was in his position for this time. And the timing of what God has them do becomes chiefly important. Did you know in your ministry, timing is important? That there are opportunities to you now that you may not have in the future. Because God has called you for a time like right now. There are things that are not available to you now that may become available in the future. And the timing of all that is key. We'll see that unfold a bit. So does Esther believe? Let's find out. Verse 15. Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and what? Fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, nor 3 nights or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise, and so will I go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So basically the lowest point in this story is not only they're a fast, but it's, hey, just spread this fast to as many people as you possibly can. I'll do it. I'll go in. It's against the law, but I'm going in. Fast with me. So we see the low point. And Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. So he fasts along with her. So they're fasting. It's representing the low point in the story, but they're fasting in prayer to God. And we can see that God is intricately involved throughout this story, although not named. Okay, chapter 5. Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house over against the king's house, and the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house over against the gate of the house. Okay? And it was so, when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. Now, is she obtained favor because she's smoking hot? Maybe. Doesn't say. Did she obtain favor because she was bold? And the king knew that she knew that coming in into him was illegal and would potentially cost her life? Maybe. The Bible doesn't tell us. But nonetheless, the king sees her take this action, and she finds grace in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. Okay, hold your finger here and turn to the book of Ephesians chapter 2. It says in verse 13, it says, but now in Christ Jesus, you who were sometimes were afar off are made nigh by the blood of Christ. So again, this scepter that was held out to redeem her from death also causes her to draw nigh unto the king. So we who are sometimes afar off and not allowed into the inner court of God are now drawn nigh by the blood of Jesus Christ. Okay, back to Esther. So, what happens? What happens in chapter 5? Esther comes in, and the king says to her, "All right, you did it. You got close to me. You're not going to get killed. What do you want? Why did you come in here? Why did you risk your life?" And Esther says unto him, "All I want is for you to come to a feast. You and Haman, come to a feast at my house that I'm going to make for you." That's it. That's all she asks for. That indicates something very strongly to us, is that she already has the information from God by Mordecai of what she's supposed to do. She's supposed to intercede on behalf of the Jews. She's given the opportunity. This might seem like the time to strike. What do you want? Up to half my kingdom, he says. What do you want up to half my kingdom? She could have, at that moment, potentially said, "Deliver the Jews. That's what I'm here to ask you for." But she doesn't. She says, "Come to a feast that I might prepare for you." So, chapter 5 goes on. He comes to the feast. Haman goes with him, goes with the king. And then he says, "All right, we just ate your great feast. What do you want? Why are you doing all this? Ask me up to half my kingdom. I will give it to you." And she, again, has this time to strike, to say, "Deliver the Jews, please. That's what I'm here for." But she says, "Just come back a little bit later to another feast that I'll prepare for you and Haman." Why does Esther wait? It's a great question. And it's because she's been called for a certain time to do God's will. She has the authority. She has the decree. She has the revelation from God. But she doesn't have the timing yet. And so she is waiting for the intersection between God's timing and God's word to pull the trigger. And we see why in chapter 6, verse 1. "On that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of records of the chronicles that they read before the king. And it was written that Mordecai had told of Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keeper of the door, who sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, 'What honor and dignity hath been done for Mordecai for this?' Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, 'There's nothing done for him.'" Why did Esther wait? Because God had plans in motion for her to do something later. And in the interim, in this night between, the king, lo and behold, has a dream, and he can't sleep. So he just says, "Hey, just read me some stuff. Just read me out of the book of the stuff we write down." And lo and behold, they read about Mordecai, who had saved the king from Bigthan and Teresh. So then the king says, "Well, what did we do for him for this?" And nothing had been done. So the next day, the king calls in Haman and says, "Haman, how should we honor somebody who deserves the biggest honor of all?" And Haman's like, "Oh, sweet, that must mean me." So he like outlines this whole parade and all this stuff that he wants done for himself. And then right as he's done explaining it, the king says, "Oh, perfect. I want you to go do that for Mordecai." Haman goes, "What? Are you kidding? The guy who I'm trying to get killed, I'm so angry at, I'm not only killing him, but I'm killing everyone related to him in the entire kingdom. I need to go take him and give him the honor I wanted for myself." So, and lo and behold, not only does Haman have to set up the honor for Mordecai, he's got to lead it. He's got to take and be the front man in this entire procession. So at the end of this whole parade, it's at the end of chapter 6, Haman is just wrecked, just low and distraught, can't believe it just happened. But the last verse in chapter 6 gets a little worse for him. It says, "And while they were yet talking with him," so he's complaining to all his friends and his wife, "came the king's chamberlains and hastened to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared." The first opportunity Esther had, she said, "Just come to a banquet." The second opportunity Esther had, she said, "Just come to a second banquet." In the meantime, God's at work. God's at work glorifying Mordecai. God's at work reminding the king of what Mordecai had done. Reminding the king, by the way, Mordecai's a Jew. And then Mordecai gets this great honor, Haman gets this great humiliation, and the timing strikes that right at this moment, the second banquet happens. It's almost a repeat of the first banquet, except at the end, the king says, all right, Esther, what do you want up to half my kingdom? And she says, chapter 7, she rats out Haman, more or less. And she says, there's somebody out there who wants to kill me, who wants to kill everybody who I love, and wants to kill my whole family. He says, who is it? Who's trying to do this to you? And she says, that guy right there, Haman. And Haman gets fearful. Why? Because his status just got brought lower. Esther's and Mordecai's just got elevated. And now it's Esther, Mordecai, and the king all opposing him. And so this information comes out. Haman finds out that she's a Jew. And now he's terrified because she's really high in the king's sight. That says, then the king's so steaming mad that he walks out of the room. Haman, maybe wisely, but in the end badly, falls on his knees and kind of tugs at Esther to like beg her, please spare me, please spare me. And I think you guys could imagine that scene. It's like something so dire is about to happen. Somebody's just like falling on the person to try and get some mercy. Well, while he's doing that, he more or less knocks her over onto her bed. As the king's walking in, and he says, are you going to force yourself on my wife? So he's always steaming mad. He walks out of the room to cool off. He comes back in. He finds this. That's the end for Haman. So verse 8 says, and the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine. And Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Then said the king, will you force the queen also before me in the house? And the word went out of the king's mouth that covered Haman's face. So it's like putting a bag over his head. And Harbonam, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, oh, behold, look at this. Also the gallows, 50 cubits high, so that's about 75 feet high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him thereon. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, and he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. So you see this convergence of God's timing, God's working, God's behind the scenes dealing to take care of this evil man, this guy Haman, who had tried to obliterate God's people. Haman had intended to hang Mordecai on these gallows, but it ended up hanging him. If you've ever heard the term hang as high as Haman, I don't know if that's used very often anymore. It used to be a common phrase. This is what it's talking about, is that it's someone so reprehensible that you want to hang them as high as Haman. So God's people are delivered from Haman, yet there's still this decree that he had published on behalf of the king. And it becomes evident that the king says that anything I've sealed is done. I can't undo that. But maybe there's something else I can do for you. So he turns the signet ring's now freed from Haman. So he goes and he gives it over to Mordecai and says, Mordecai, whatever it takes, you write out a new decree to go right alongside that old decree, and maybe we can deliver your people. So Mordecai now has the power, and he writes this decree on behalf of the king. And we'll pick that up in chapter 8, verse 15. And Mordecai went out in the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with garments of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. And the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. So they have all these positive things reinforced to them, because now Haman, their enemy, is gone, and in his place is Mordecai. The decree that Haman had made is now supplemented by this new decree. And the new decree says that the Jews are allowed to fight back, more or less. That the king now authorizes on behalf of the Jews that they're willing to fight against their enemies. And a cool thing probably happened here is when the first decree went out, the real enemies of the Jews revealed themselves, the ones who really had it in for them. Now this new decree comes out. Oh, and by the way, Mordecai is now number two. The queen is also a Jew. And so all the governors are like, well, let's just go with the Jews. Like, that sounds like a better plan for us. So they get this reinforcement of all the power throughout the empire. And now all the enemies are like, oh, well, wait. I thought we were going to get to win and spoil you. But the decree comes out, no, the Jews get to fight against their enemies. And it's interesting, it says that they can take the spoil from the enemies. Verse 16, the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. So we see this elevation back out of the fasting phase, back into the feast. The joy is returned because they can defend themselves, and God has worked to get them the advantage. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. It's like, well, we're with them. Those guys are on the ups. Now, in the 12th month, chapter 9, verse 1, that is, the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and the decree drew near to put in execution in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. And the Jews gathered themselves together. Everybody's like, we're backing the Jews. Like, they got the king's ear. The king's on their side. We're on his side. We're with them. They go and they get rid of all their enemies. It's something like 76,000 of their enemies get wiped out. But it's interesting, too, is that when you read this, you'll see that they don't take any of the spoil when they destroy their enemies. And it's interesting, because in the decree, they were allowed to take it. It was part of the decree. Go take all the spoil of anyone you kill. But the Jews don't. And it's interesting, because just because something is allowed doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And here, people might say, well, the Jews were just after that spoil. Those people wanted to kill their enemies and just get rich over it. But they destroyed their enemies, and it glorified God. And there was nothing to be said about them just wanting to get spoil, even though they had the right to. And so, just because we, as Christians, have the right to do things, not all things are expedient. So we can do things, we're free to do anything we want in Christ, but we have the great privilege of restraining so that God can get the glory from our lives. Okay, let's close this out in Esther chapter 9, verse 20. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both nigh and far. So to everybody in the entire kingdom, he writes this proclamation. To establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies and the month which was turned them from sorrow to joy and from mourning into a good day, that they should make them days of feasting and joy and to send portions one of another and gifts to the poor. We'll read on, verse 23. And the Jews undertook to do such a thing that they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them, because Haman the son of that guy, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, the lot to consume them and to destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged from the gallows. Wherefore, they call these days Purim, after the name of Pur, or lots. Therefore, for all the word of this letter, and of that which they have seen concerning this matter, and which have come unto them, the Jews ordained, and took upon them, and upon their seed, and upon all such as joined themselves unto them, so as it should not fail, that they would keep these 2 days according to the writing, and according to their appointed time every year. So out of this, so 2,500 years ago, the new holiday of Purim was established. And it was a time of feasting. It's interesting, the Jews still celebrate Purim to this day. And it's kind of a mixture of Halloween and Christmas. They dress up in costumes because Esther hid her identity by direction of God. So they wear costumes. And then they have great feasts and gift giving. And God established this to remind them that when they were in their most sorrowful fasting state, that God took them out of that by his divine hand and turned a curse into a blessing and sorrow into great joy. And that's the memorial that God wanted to remind them of even when things are going wrong, that even if it seems like you're trying to do right and all is working out bad, that God has the power to turn sorrow into joy. And he made that a yearly thing that they would do to remind themselves of this time period. And I'm reminded of Purim because of the casting of lots. And when you think about Jesus Christ when he was on the cross, that they cast lots for his possessions as he was being crucified. And at the most dark hour in all of human history, when the Messiah was hanging on a tree, then out of that sorrow came great joy. So from where they had cast lots for Christ's death, God brought great life to his people, and we're all the beneficiaries of that. And so when we think about when we think about things, then there's crying and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Let's do one more verse. Sorry, guys, I know this ran a little long, but let's read Malachi 10:3. Esther 10:3, not Malachi. About Malachi. It says, "For Malachi the Jew was next to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted to the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed." Mordecai is a great study in a servant of God. Is that when you read through this, Mordecai is an upstanding moral person. Is that when something falls into his lap, he takes it up. Like Esther, who has no mother and father, he takes her in as his own father. Mordecai has the stones to stand up when all else bow. Mordecai has the audacity to trust God even when he knows what he's doing that's right turns wrong on him. Mordecai is a great servant of God because he didn't seek after his own. Mordecai was a great servant of God because he sought after the well-being of all the people of God. And he's a great figure for us to identify with and to follow after. That we seek the benefit of all God's people. We don't seek after our own. We don't bow our knee down to the Hamans of the day. Whenever the devil sets up some idol for people to bow down to, something contrary to the word of God, we don't bow our knee as Mordecai didn't bow his knee. And even if it seems like things might be all going against us, we have the trust to keep following God and to see where God will turn sorrow into great joy. So Mordecai is a great man in the Bible. Esther is a great woman in the Bible. And their impact is so far-reaching. Because when you remember that the children of Israel were all basically in this kingdom of Persia, that included in that was Judea. And included in Judea was Zerubbabel. And from Zerubbabel, we got Jesus Christ. He's part of the Christ line. That this decree would have impacted him and impacted Christ. But the belief of these two save all of God's people, and we are still the beneficiaries today. So, Christ came. He didn't get born tomorrow, right? But he did come. And he came because there have been believers throughout history who were willing to not bend their knee, but to stand up for God. So, that's my employment for you. And additionally, read the book of Esther this week. So God bless you guys.